Hello, my name is Kanishka Rathore. Welcome to Future of Cities podcast. The main aim of Future of Cities is to raise open questions on urban future and steer discussions on what the future of cities can and should be. We regularly host fireside chats, deep dive with experts, and panel discussions on Clubhouse. The topic which we are discussing is breathing art into cities for a greener future. You can probably guess that we're talking about art, but most importantly, we'll be talking about Jasmine's work, which some of you might be aware of. And Jasmine is one of the, let's say, well-known artists who has managed to, create a huge impact by linking her artwork towards, environment and by addressing some of the key environmental issues. And also, Jasmine is not just an artist, she's also a physicist. She's a public speaker, an innovator. So a lot of things we'll be knowing from her, starting from her background and how, she has been able to connect all these dots together to create the work which she's doing. I think I will let Jasmine speak more about that. So with that, welcome Jasmine once again to the Future of Cities Club. Would you like to maybe start by, introducing yourself, give us all a little bit background on your work, and perhaps, share with us the purpose of your artistic work?
First of all, thank you so much for inviting me, because I've been in some of your rooms and you have the most incredible speakers, and I'm not a mayor or a legislator or anything like that. So that's, first of all, I wanted to congratulate you on just using that divergent thinking that I talk about all the time and inviting me in. So thank you so much. I'll talk a little bit about my background in a moment, but because I am a visual artist, I would encourage people just to go and check out some of my Instagram so that you can actually, it's very difficult to describe the visual. It's so much easier to obviously go and see it. But the piece that I've replaced my photo with for this afternoon is a piece called Famine. And it's one of a series of four that I made based on the Four Horsemen. I called it the Four Horsemen of the Air Apocalypse. And it's actually my son's hands holding an asthma puffer. 1 in 10 people now require an asthma puffer in order to breathe. This sort of fundamental act, the most important of our physiological needs. But it's made out of a material, an incredible material that can actually absorb nitrogen dioxide or NOx from the air. So a 3 kilogram sculpture in a room can clean it for approximately 60 years. And there's a very long story to getting to something like this, that whenever you see a finished piece of work, of course, you kind of have no idea of all the dots that have been joined. So in answer to Kanishka's kind of question, a little bit about my background, came from an immigrant family who obviously at that time growing up, there was no way I was going to be allowed to go and study art, although I did demonstrate a gift for it at quite a young age. And it was always, be a lawyer, be a doctor, one of the professions that you can put a name to. And I did study the science with the intents of going into medicine. That didn't happen. But I ended up doing a science degree, and then I ended up doing a PhD at UCL, which is actually the hardest thing I've ever done. It was on rare earth doping of fiber optics. So it was at a time when fiber optic technology was really exploding. And I had to do some incredibly difficult mathematics, and I'm not very good at mathematics. So the thing that got me through was my visual thinking. And at the same time as doing that, I was also going to art college in the evening after years of going to life classes. And I trained quite classically as a draftsman or draftswoman. I had a brilliant tutor who said, you really do need to go and start to understand the language of art. So I was doing both together and in secret, because it was at a time when people didn't combine the two. Now it seems so very acceptable, and I think it's utterly brilliant that we can do that. And we have the word polymath to describe people like myself. I didn't realize I was a polymath. And I actually think this polymathic thinking is one of the ways we're going to solve the problems for the future. But anyway, I was studying art And when I finished at UCL, I knew I was not rigorous enough to be a scientist. I'm not a natural born scientist. But I had to use this shiny PhD for something. And this was 20 odd years ago or so. We, myself and a business partner, we created, I think, one of the first outreach companies in the UK, going around the country and trying to take the fear out of science. And as the years progressed, so I was making art, I was running this, I was bringing up my son. And as the years progressed, it became much more about the science and the art. And then it became about the science and the art and the environment. And I think because I have literally spoken to tens, if not hundreds of thousands of children, this sort of, I realized that I had a responsibility that I hadn't actually had before. It wasn't simply about creating something because I could. There was a compulsion to create something that created a message. And that was how I kind of continued. And then in 2010, it was with Hove Museum, there was an exhibition which really did change my practice. And it was called Precious. And this was way before the conversation on plastics. This is way before we realized the number of plastics that were going to deluge the planet. I think most of the plastic pollution we now have has happened in the last 13 years. But we were digging around in, we were in refuse centers, we were, and I remembered a classic physics experiment. So as an engineer, if you want to create a bridge or a building, before you go off and spend millions of pounds building it, you create it out of perspex and you stress it and you strain it and you look at it in polarized light. So as a physicist, I'd known about this experiment for a long time. And then literally one morning with a change in perspective, I leapt out of bed and I went, oh, my goodness, that's painting with light. And for Hove Museum, I remember taking loads of disused, discarded bits of plastic, and I started to create two-dimensional pieces using polarized light, which change in color as you move around them. So I was doing that for quite a while. I was doing some public speaking. I remember working with Blue Dot Generation, and I met Surfers Against Sewage. And then I was commissioned to make something for Euston Town, and I knew that I couldn't do it out of plastic. This was something that, you know, I'd never made a piece of public art before. And it had to last. It had to have longevity. And I guess because of my wonderfully sort of divergent background, you know, I know a lot of scientists, a lot of engineers. I obviously know a lot of artists. And at the time, serendipity, you know, I do love the universe. It does bring you things when you need it. Somebody said, go and speak to this company. They found a new material. And it absorbs pollution. And so 4 years ago or so, I kind of approached them and said, listen, nobody knows what you're doing. Please, will you allow me to try and create some art from it for this public commission in order to drive awareness, not just to what you're doing and that we have the materials that can really make a difference, but in order to kind of start to use art as a narrative for change. So that's, I guess, what I've been doing. So the Euston sculpture has been enormously delayed, not at my end, because it was made a couple of years ago, but it is actually going up on the 15th of June. And I'm incredibly excited about it. I'm no doubt Kanishka will ask me more about it later. And there is a second one at the Horniman Museum, but that's, yeah, just a little bit in a nutshell about me. Thank you, Kanishka.
Thank you very much, Jasmine, for introducing yourself and also for taking us through the journey. I mean, one question which pops up in my mind before we, of course, go into details of some of your work is, of course, your background. So you kind of embrace this dual worlds of scientist and the artist. So how has this, you know, science background influenced your art? Is this something which indirectly or directly fueled your interest in the area of environment?
Thank you, Kanishka. The environmental story came later, but I really am, first of all, I am without a shadow of a doubt a dopamine junkie. I really am. I get such a buzz from what would happen if we did this. And both science and art are based in that joy of things, that awe and wonder of things. I talk about rainbows all the time. And of course, when I was thinking about this talk, I was remembering all the rainbows that were drawn in the windows and on the pavements in the last year. So, you know, I kind of, from the science point of view, I understand how a rainbow works. From an art point of view, almost impossible to paint. But it's that awe. It's realizing that there is this magic in the world, which I think actually as grown-ups we tend to forget. So science and art for me, they're different in terms of the fact that with science you are restricted because you have the natural laws. And yet quantum mechanics does kind of go against that, you know, doing classical physics, and it's about the, you know, the deterministic, it's the Newtonian laws, you go from A to B, you know the distance, you know how long it's going to take you, and then you descend into the quantum world where it isn't anything like that at all. And I think there was, I mean, I sometimes look at my thesis and I go, oh my goodness, who actually wrote that? But there was one, I think there was one thing that I remember from it. And I had to, one of the things I had to do is I had to calculate new energy levels for a material, depending upon when we put a new material in it. And would we still be able to get the same light out of it for the fiber optic, simply put. And I remember finding, right, I can't actually find where I started. I can't actually find where I end up, but I can find the difference in the middle. And that was the point at which I realized that certainly for me, physics was about the space in the middle of things, right? It wasn't about the outcome or the study, it was about this space in the middle. And, you know, when you talk about semiconductor physics, it's all about holes and how things fit together. So, yeah, that's that space in the middle, which I guess is a metaphor for, well, things that I actually use in my art as well. So, yeah, I kind of learned that sort of rigorousness from science, which I then tried to abandon as much as possible. But for me, it's about experimentation, completely about experimentation. In science, you would call it innovation. In art, we call it the avant-garde. And unfortunately, one of the things I have discovered, I used to think that the idea was everything. I now know it's not just about the idea, it's about timing. And if the zeitgeist isn't right for something, it doesn't matter how far ahead you are of things, it's going to take a while for it to be accepted. And if you think of science and art, it's only relatively recently that we've, you know, made these disparate subjects. You know, the Royal Academy in London has the Royal Society of Chemistry next door, the Royal Society of Astronomy on the other side. So, you know, until relatively recently, these things were, they were seen as one and the same thing, just using different tools perhaps to express them. And I did do one when I was thinking again about this talk. Actually, there was an article in The Guardian this week from Derby Silk Mill Museum in the UK, which was the first mechanized factory in the world. And they have just finished, I think, an £18 million renovation. And about 6 years ago or so, I did a fellowship in creativity there. And one of the reasons I love this museum is that it's a maker's museum. So at the back, there is a whole workshop. I learned how to use a CNC machine and I designed a giant spirograph for families and kids to come in and use so that they could understand cogs and wheels. But next door to that museum, they also have the Joseph Wright Museum of Painting. And Joseph Wright was one of the sort of main painters of the Enlightenment period. So you had the industrial era happening alongside the Enlightenment kind of movement. And that, and very often you do find throughout history that we have these movements that happen in parallel. They're both happening in science and art at the same time. And if you think of relativity and cubism, you know, Picasso and Einstein, they did exactly the same thing. And to me, it's a joy now that we're starting to kind of find the commonalities and not the differences. I hope that's clarified that a bit.
No, indeed. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And it's great to see that. And as you said earlier, I mean that, you know, we need to not look at things separately, but, you know, combine different aspects, or let's say areas together, to find solutions to the modern challenges which we are facing. And that's something I would say you have been managed to do quite beautifully, especially because we are talking about your art. We heard that the pollution levels in London has, you know, reduced drastically. But I would really love to hear your views on, you know, what you think about the air pollution in London, and did it play a role in your work on environment and art?
I guess for me the threads came together at the same time. I had not given it a huge amount of thought until about 5 years ago, and that I think with all of these conversations, when, you know, when we talk about future cities and renewables and climate change, it really is only when it becomes personal, really personal, that I think it's almost like you have a light bulb moment. And because otherwise it is, it's just out there somewhere. And this, to me, is one of the reasons that art, music, literature is so important, because at that moment you are interacting with something incredibly personally. But for me, it happened when my son was 18 and he had a massive asthma attack, which he'd never had before. He hardly ever needed his puffer, only during hay fever season. And so we were sat in Lewisham Hospital. So I actually live in one of the parts of South London, which not exactly where I live. It's, well, it is quite close. We do have quite bad pollution. But anyway, Kieran was, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, sat in accident and emergency, and watching him on a ventilator obviously gave me time to think. And it was the first time ever that I'd actually thought about the actual act of breathing, because we don't. You know, you have, you know, what is it, 700 million breaths in an average lifetime. But it's just something that's automatic. You don't think about it. You don't question it. And, you know, obviously we talk about the SDGs and things that we need. But breathing is one of those, you know, the most fundamental things. You can only live for 3 minutes without it. So this idea was in my head. I had no idea what to do with it. But, you know, I'm used to that. I know that we have all the ideas. And then about a year later, the Euston thing happened. In fact, I was just reading again in prep for this, that was it, October 2020. London was the worst city in Europe for health costs from air pollution. Apparently, it costs something like £1,500 extra to each individual who's living in the city of London because of the levels of pollution through, you know, missed work, whether they're ill or they're having to look after their kids, you know, long-term medication, obviously premature death. And I also remember reading once that I think it's 4 million people that die in the world as a result of pollution. We have more deaths globally than we do gun crime. And I just thought, if you could put that on the front page of a newspaper, people might sit up, listen. But of course, you can't see air. You know, you only see knocks when, usually in the summer, you know, when you have a beautiful sunset. But part of that beautiful sunset, part of the colour that you can see, is the knocks that's sitting in the air. And in December of this year, we had a ruling in Southwark in South London, and it was the first ever death that was attributed to pollution. And it was a young girl called Ellie Kisser Deborah, and her mother had campaigned for years about this. And the poor child had been in and out of hospital, I think, 27 times. She had cardiac problems. And Southwark is, it's sort of an inner city part of London. You know, a lot of people all living on top of one another, a lot of schools, a lot of cars sitting there, you know, with their engines running. And her mother really did campaign for this. And so it's becoming much more visible. And now we do have the Breathe campaign in London, but we still have some way to go. And it's not just NOx, of course, it's all sorts of other particulates. And we do get it as a byproduct of combustion, but you also get it in your kitchen when you're cooking, for example. And I know this is about future cities, but it's also in rural areas. Again, I was reading that it's the poorest people that suffer the most with pollution, but it's the richest people that take the longest journeys and create a lot of that pollution. So it's not just inequity in environment, it's, you know, it's inequity with people as well.
When you talk about your work and this NoxTech technology which you are using, would you be able to share a little bit more about how it is, you know, kind of able to absorb this pollutants? And is this the only work which you are doing in the area of environment, or has there been something else? You mentioned plastic a little bit before. So is that also something which you started doing to make an impact towards the environment?
Thank you, Kanishka. For me, process materiality is my starting point. And, you know, as I said before, because I am a bit of an experimentalist, I will look at a material and go, yes, but how else can this be used? I guess that's the physicist, that's the scientist in me. So, and the other thing I really wanted to say is, of course, you know, one or two sculptures or even a material like this, this is not the solution. Of course, it isn't the solution. You know, because a lot of people have kind of said to me, oh, we could have benches and we could have this. And I go, that's not the solution. What I'm trying to do with this art is to get people to understand that we have the innovations. And it's not just the innovations, it's a way of thinking. You know, I'm kind of a big believer that, for example, you know, as we enter this new revolution, which is one of concept, it is a conceptual revolution. We're leaving behind this sort of, you know, the logical, the way that we were kind of taught with the Industrial Revolution, you know, the deterministic, the mathematical, the rational. And it's becoming much more about the ability, high concept and high touch. So this idea of design and empathy and connection making, play and meaning, the best things about what make us human. And so although, yes, obviously I'm creating art to do this, being able to, for example, being invited to speak about this, because, you know, I'm not the only person who thinks in this way. There are many, many more. And goodness knows how many students I have taught over the years. But yes, going back to Knox Tech. So Knox Tech is effectively, if we imagine plastic as a carbon-based polymer, Knox Tech is a silicon-based polymer, so geopolymer. It is a byproduct of quarrying. It does come in a powder form. I obviously don't know all the ingredients because I've had to sign a lot of secrecy documents. And it was discovered 40 years ago, so it's not new. It was discovered 40 years ago by a French professor called Professor Davodovich. And he wrote some very interesting papers. Again, like anyone who's really cutting edge, a lot of his work was just poo-pooed as utter nonsense. One of his theories were that the pyramids were not constructed from blocks or cut, you know, constructed. They were actually cast from a very similar material. So it's a powder. It gets mixed with a really rather nasty solvent, quite a clumpy material. And then it cures, not by air, it cures chemically, and with time it becomes harder and harder and harder. The one test piece that we have is outside Darwin's house in southeast England, and it's a little plaque outside his house, and it hasn't actually changed. So this stuff cures, becomes incredibly hard, and when Elsitech were working on the material, they were only looking at it in terms of a strong material that could be an insulator. So it has all sorts of amazing properties. It can be heated up to 2000 degrees. Once it's cured, it's highly inert. It is brittle, but it is very strong. So for the Euston sculpture, for example, as much as I didn't want to, I had to put fiberglass in it, in the middle of it, to give it added strength. But when they sent it to Cambridge, they sent it to UCL, they sent it to various places for analyses. And as a byproduct, they really didn't know that it could absorb 15% by weight of NOx pollutions. And the way that it does it is effectively like any polymer. A polymer has a vast internal surface area. You know, I always liken it to a huge plate of spaghetti where every strand is incredibly sticky. And because of the chemical bonding inside the geopolymer, it's highly attractive. It's a bit like, you know, oil and soap, highly attractive to these NOx molecules who just go and stick to it. And they stay there until it rains, for example, if it's outside. So, and then it gets washed away. It gets washed away as a weak nitric acid. But it can just absorb vast, vast quantities. I was amazed. As I said at the beginning, a 3-kilogram sculpture in a room can clean it for about 60 years. So that's the material itself. But, you know, this company has been struggling. They've been struggling for years, even though they're working with something incredibly innovative. And actually, by creating the art that I've been doing, we're driving more awareness to what they're doing. And as I say, with Euston going up, there is quite a big media campaign planned, and I'm hoping that we will drive even more awareness to what they're doing, Kanishka.
Thank you very much, Jasmine, for sharing this and for letting us know also about this company. It's quite surprising, but I think it's great that, you know, you're using your art to bring more awareness about this this particular polymer, if I understand correctly. So, I mean, from that, I mean, you talked about some of your other art pieces, which, as you said, were sent to different universities. But I also read that the mayor of London, Fern, has commissioned you to install an innovative and unique sculpture. I think it's called Breathe, as part of the Euston Green Link walking route. So would you like to share a little bit more about that? Is this part of a major initiative in London? And also if you can tell us a little bit about this sculpture, maybe some other sculptures which have been installed in London, and what's the main message behind them?
So what I would probably ask people to do is to go onto my Instagram. That's probably the easiest way, because it's the second picture in. So Breathe, yes, the Mayor of London Fund did actually sponsor this. And it's part of a program. At one point, it was called the Euston Green Link. So the Euston Road is the second most polluted road in the whole of the UK, or it was. I'm not entirely certain now, but it's highly polluted. Let's put it that way. But if you walk down the side streets off Euston, you hit Regent's Park. So you can actually avoid some of those major walkways. And by avoiding, you know, sort of going on the big roads, you also start to encounter small coffee shops, small community shops, you know, restaurants, places that you can kind of interact with. And so the whole point of the project was one to kind of get people off these polluted roads and get them to walk greener pastures. And for me, artistically, so I had a material, but I then had to find the, you know, the artistic inspiration. The picture next to her on my Instagram feed is called Flower Girl Who Will Awaken Upon the Buzzing of the Bees. And that's actually been a dream project to date. So that was working with the Hornimer Museum down the road from me, not far from Southwark, where Ella died. And she's a figure who's sleeping. She's wrapped in petals. I like to imagine that she will waken again when all the insects do reappear. Because we now know that pollution doesn't just affect human beings. It stops the tiniest creatures, the pollinating creatures that give us one in every mouthful of food. It stops them finding their pollinating flowers. And so this wonderful project that came out of nowhere is a sculpture that's sitting in the middle of a bee garden, which has been specially designed to grow flowers that attract pollinators. And it's been an incredible project, actually, from the number of people that I've had messaging me to the people who are saying, what do I need to grow in my garden? How does this work? How can I help? And the Hornimer Museum was, I think, the first museum in the UK also to declare a culture emergency, which more and more museums are doing. And, you know, in terms of future cities, I think museums have an enormous, they are like hubs for things like this to happen. And from this, you know, we have education programs, growing programs. So from this one sort of project, an awful lot more things have come. So it's been a dream project for me, Kanishka.
Thank you very much, Jasmine. And I encourage all the audience members to check out the pictures, at least on Jasmine's Instagram, to know more about this sculptures, Breathe and Flower Girl. And of course, for those of you who are in London, you're lucky to be able to visit those. And I'm also very much looking forward to you know, visiting London as soon as I get vaccinated. That's on one of my to-do list to do when I visit London. And I will definitely try to you know, come and see the art which is installed. What about COP26? You know, that's also happening in the UK. Do you have any plans, Jasmine, to maybe showcase your work, or, you know, use it also to further spread the message?
Well, unfortunately, we did put in a submission, but I heard yesterday that submission was not successful. So I know that there will be quite a lot of art shows happening. I'm already involved in those. It would be lovely to do something more directly related to COP. So if anyone is in the audience and, you know, they would like to reach out, it would be lovely to hear from you, because it's, you know, we've had so many, you know, we've had many art movements. I think the art movement, hopefully, that will now really start to gather momentum is the one based on the environment. Because, you know, wonderful thing, just to give you an example, when Oliver Ellison did the Weather Project at the Tate, which I think was one of the most popular exhibitions they'd ever had in the Turbine Hall, you can now, from that, they developed something called Little Sun, which is a solar powered sort of little, it's a little hub, which basically I think at the moment over 3 million people worldwide have it. So, you know, if you don't have electricity at night, of course, you can't read, you can't educate yourself, you can't sit with your family, you're limited in what you can do. And that was as a direct result of, you know, sort of that project. So, and I've also been invited to do something really quite major next year, but I can't talk about that yet. But yeah, and also just building towards an exhibition and doing so much more of this type of thing. And I know that I have been, the Craft Council, for example, has said a lot of their students now, when they're saying, what is it you would like to have some workshops in? They're asking for things about sustainability and the environment. So this is something that's really starting to gather momentum, which I find incredibly exciting. Because people want to know, you know, what is it I can do? How can I change things? And just to give you again, just one more little example, I did a project with two other artists last year with not Ecova, but Method UK, which is a part of Ecova. And it was for cleaning fluids. And I remember saying, I don't want to have my work on the front of a, you know, cleaning fluid bottle. There you go, me and my clothes perspective. And then they kind of explain, you know, it's recycled plastic and it's all about messaging. And so we created a limited set of artist bottles. And I could put the message on there that, you know, these bottles are so beautiful, you don't want to throw them away. And for me, I have my butterflies on there, you know, talk about the messaging in terms of allowing your lawn to be slightly longer, you know, growing certain flowers. And actually, again, that project has been amazing because everyone cleans. The number of pictures I've had from people going, I found the bottles, I'm never throwing them away, I've just learned about this. So, yeah, this is gathering traction. So, yeah, anyway, I'll stop.
No, thank you for sharing, Jasmine. I mean, also from the audience member, indeed, I mean, I encourage you to contact Jasmine if you would like to, you know, collaborate and spread the message, especially for COP26. I have one final question, probably. It's just about, you know, again, the whole broader message about, you know, the role of art and how it can have a major impact on society. And as you said, Jasmine, on our urban future. So do you also believe that, you know, art can change people's perception on these major global challenges such as climate change and air pollution, especially in cities? And what would be your, you know, key message, let's say, to our listeners, both who are listening now on Clubhouse and those who will be listening in the future on our podcast, which I'm sure includes, you know, artists, engineers, scientists, urban policymakers, you know, physicists, and hopefully from other areas, from different cities all over the world. So what would be your key message to them?
First of all, I've kind of experienced this. You know, obviously, I work with my hands. I create. I'm not in a position to legislate, but I've worked with sufficient people to actually see this create change. So, for example, one of the things that I used to run workshops in was something called Creative Engineers Can Change the World. And we had some of the world's top engineers come to these sessions, and I remember them. They'd come in and they'd be going, you want me to do what? You want me to sculpt with string, do you? You want me to? And what was fascinating was that obviously these, you know, incredibly highly skilled people that were used to converging on things, when they were allowed or when they gave themselves the permission to start to play with things, it didn't work for every single one. But it worked for quite a lot of them. And even now, sometimes I will get an email out of the blue just saying, you know what, you've completely changed the way that I look at things. So, for example, there was one lovely guy that kept a notebook with all his engineering drawings and everything was in black and white. And I said, why don't you just introduce a bit of colour? And the next week he came in and everything. And he said, you know, it's actually changed my practice. Now, these are small little changes, right? And then I've worked with the Institute of Civil Engineers. And, you know, I know certainly over here we are screaming out for more creativity. But you know, in order to find solutions, you know, Einstein was the best one at saying, you know, you can't, you're defined as insane if you keep trying to do things, you know, trying to solve something the way that you kind of created it in the first place. I really do believe that we have to diverge from that. We have to have other types of thinkers at the table. We really, really do. If nothing else, just to challenge the thinking that's in that room, because it really does challenge things. In terms of the arts and in cities, you know, we have been hammered worse. You know, sometimes we talk about inequality and inequity. If you're a creative in the last year, the bottom has fallen out of your world, you know, whether you're a musician or whatever, it really, really has. And yet, when you think of people visiting major cities, one of the reasons they go is for the culture. And it needs to be appreciated, not just in terms of, you know, people imagining that we do things because we're passionate. Of course we do. But things have to be remunerated and also have to be appreciated because, you know, the way that artists think, as I said at the beginning, is one of the ways we're going to propel into the future. But it's so difficult to put a value on it. You know, we're so good at, you know, as a scientist, we're so good at data and graphs and being quantitative. And, you know, whenever I do my creativity sessions, people kind of say, yeah, but how do we measure? And I say, we can't. But I can guarantee that there are some people that will have life-changing ideas or they will completely change. Not everyone. But you know enough, and then of course they will feed it on to the next person. And in terms of you know urban hubs, we need places where these creative people can live, where they can afford to live, because it's not just about what we create, but it's about the teaching. Education is a huge, huge aspect. And actually, just this morning, I got a letter, which you know, when I have a couple of hard weeks, I get something like this, and I go, oh, that's why I do what I do. And it's one of my chemical engineering students who made it to the semi-finals of what was it, the Mayor's Entrepreneur Competition. And she actually said, I remember your design sessions and you know, I've never forgotten them and they really helped me. Now, when I get something like that, and you don't often hear these things, you know, people won't say to you that thing that I saw or that thing that I experienced changed the way that I changed, you know, changes the way that I look at the world. But that I think is incredibly important. And in terms of things like planning, it's taken us 4 years to get the planning for, you know, all the permits and everything. Why do things have to be so complicated? So I wish that things could be made a little easier. And certainly for me, I've now experienced that art goes together with growing. You know, we have lots of little guerrilla sort of planting programs. We have micro forests. You know, some of the greatest sculptures I've ever seen are trees. So I don't really differentiate between nature and art as such. They go together. And the act of growing is probably one of the most beautiful creative acts you can ever experience. When you asked me where my interest in the environment came from, one of the things was my father growing his own food. For years, I never paid attention. And, you know, and then I suddenly looked at a tomato in an entirely different way because I thought, that is your blood, sweat, and tears, that tomato. And when I ate it, it was an experience like I'd never had one before. So I think it's that. I think it's getting people close to the problem, getting close to things, experiencing it, so they want to protect it.